In Aesop's fable, the fox, after futile efforts to reach a juicy clump of grapes, scorns them as being sour. I can imagine him haughtily turning up his nose and swishing his tail as he harumphs away, belittling the coveted fruit only because he can't have it. How often do we, like Mr. Fox, sully our spirits by falling prey to the sour grape syndrome of jealousy, envy, or judgment of ourselves as not being up to snuff? Sour grapes should not be a daily snack. If you find a sour grape fermenting in your mouth, it's wise to immediately change its essence with a thought of gratitude.
We are continually seduced by society and our own need to do more, earn more, spend more, into continuously complicating our lives. Although some high-powered activity is stimulating, even fun, and sometimes necessary, too much is numbing and debilitating. The price many of us pay for an uncomplicated existence is poor health, loss of serenity, fractured relationships, and an unspoken lament of, is this all there is?
Gratitude is the finest prayer our souls can utter. Gratitude is an attitude. As with any attitude, it can be nurtured, cultivated, and changed if need be.
Gratitude, like laughter and humor, lifts our spirits and hearts, encourages us to ascend to realms of joy and appreciation. It makes us thankful for the incredible gift of life that we've been given and for the people who have chosen to share it with us.
Gratitude gentles even the roughest roads and gives wings to the heart. Buoyed by gratitude, we can sail over most situations while keeping a healthy and even joyful perspective on the landscape of our lives. Gratitude is meditation in action.
We live in an area of unadulterated abundance. Perhaps some of you live in a McMansion. I don't. Though being a retired nonprofit fundraiser, I have had the opportunity to visit a few of them. But I never found myself coveting a 12,000 square foot home, give or take a few thousand square feet. How much is enough? It's all relative, isn't it? Because I feel rich compared to those people in the world who can't access even enough fresh water to clean themselves, or to cook, or to quench their thirst every day. And that's 1/6 of the world's population. That's as if one of every 6 of you here had to walk miles to carry home a bucket of water and who go to a polluted river to wash your clothes. I feel rich compared to the millions of people who go to bed hungry. And they're not all in third world countries. Many of them are right here in Palm Beach County. Representative Ted Deutsch said that 1 in 6 families in Florida live in poverty. And he continued by saying 17% of Broward and Palm Beach County residents are not sure where their next meal is coming from. 11% of American households are at risk of hunger. I think it's pretty obvious that I have never gone to bed hungry. I am rich by comparison. In his book, How Much? A World Filled with Prosperity and Poverty, Arthur Simon took a look at an uncompromising look at America's wealth, reflecting on what dominates the hearts and motivations of our people. He diagnosed Western civilization as being sick with affluenza, or runaway materialism. And he suggests to readers how to reject the disease and set new priorities. Simon addresses Western affluence against the backdrop of a world where 900 million people are chronically starving, Of the 7 billion people in the world, almost 1 in 7 are hungry. Some other staggering world hunger statistics updated last month by Facing the Future and ThinkQuest, compiled from hunger relief organizations, showed that 1.5 million children die every year from hunger. 33% of the world population is considered to be starving. Every 3.6 seconds, someone dies from hunger. Think how many people have died from hunger just since we started our service, and how many have died just while I read this sentence. Yesterday, 20,864 people died of hunger, and this year, over 7 million will do the same. Simon's book reveals how affluenza takes control of people's lives and their goals. He sheds light on the profound reality that possessions may capture our hearts, but they're unable to nourish our souls. He says this acquisitive urge often drives us to overburden ourselves, first to earn more money and then to reap the benefits. Life gets hectic. Parents find themselves unable to give their children the time and personal attention that they need. Simon continues, the things we want are not necessarily bad. On the contrary, many of them are stunningly good, like the computer, he says, on which I'm typing this. All of us are beneficiaries of technological advances that have extended life expectancy, given us better health, better homes, better clothes, and access to information, communication, and transportation that would have been unthinkable less than a century ago. These advances have rescued vast numbers of people throughout the world, ourselves very possibly included, from what otherwise would have been a life of poverty, poor health, and early death. So what's the problem? The good life is seen as a life of prosperity, the American dream. The problem is that the desire to have more of the things we want is addictive. It can begin to define our lives and its aspirations and soon take control. When I was thinking about how much is enough, I was caught by an email sent to me by Elizabeth Hoffman about an article from the Daily Beast written by Janine DiGiovanni about Lucy, the name given to a solar-powered lantern, a new product that could transform the lives of 1.3 billion people living without electricity. It weighs only 4.5 ounces, an inch high when it's collapsed, costs $14.95, and provides 15 square feet of light. From the article, Jill Vandenbroucke is not famous, but she had a dream. She detested the fact that so much of the world lives without water or light, while those of us fortunate to do so can flick a switch and flood a room with electricity. And we often take it for granted. It was just last year in 2012 in post-earthquake Haiti, and Vandenbroucke, having worked there for years, was brainstorming. She saw women carrying firewood, not only for food, but to provide light, and she saw how long it took and how strenuous it was and the effect it was having on their health. She began to think of how she could combine high-tech business with a way that would empower poor people and give them a shot at breaking the poverty cycle. Electricity was a no-brainer. The most debilitating thing in the third world is a lack of power. It's one thing to brush your teeth by candlelight. It's another to try to heat water over a flame or to take care of children who have to go to sleep once the sun goes down because there's no other light, or to operate or to study or to live any kind of a normal life. The International Agency of Energy estimates that 1.3 billion people across the world have no access to electricity, while other billions rely on food or traditional fuels such as wood and charcoal for some of their energy. And so what started as a project by someone who could not bear to see civilians suffering turned into a catalyst for development, addressing energy poverty, targeting education, health, safety, the environment, and economic development. In just a year, Lucy is now distributed in 23 countries. And don't we take electricity, light, and power for granted? How do we moan and groan and complain if we have a temporary power interruption? We can't see perhaps the heat game, we can't play our pogo games on the internet, or a dozen of other things that we want to do. And without electricity, it's a major inconvenience. We live in an area rampant with affluenza, making it easy to look around and perhaps covet some of what they have and we do not. How about comparing what we have with the 900 million people going hungry today? How about realizing with gratitude that we have so much? We are so fortunate. Each of us lives in some kind of building with a roof over our head. We're not hungry. We're not dressed in tatters. We're not carrying water miles from a pump, or even worse, from a dirty river. How much is enough?
I once traveled with a friend who had great insight into human nature. He said, "Whenever you go, you can find something to complain about. If we travel, we can complain about lumpy beds and crowded airports. But if we stay home, we can complain that we never go anywhere interesting and there's never anything good on television." In Japanese language, there is the term on. The meaning of on often includes a sense of gratitude combined with a desire to repay others for what we have been given. It's not just that we feel grateful or that we express our gratitude, but that we actually experience a sincere desire to give something back. We might think of it as an appreciation that stimulates a sense of obligation. Not an externally imposed obligation, but a sense of obligation that arises naturally within us as we recognize how we have been supported and cared for by others.
The Fix had a hit single from back in the 90s called "How Much Is Enough." Some of the words of that song are, "How much is enough? Good enough is not good enough. Don't complain that you've got it tough. With all you have, your life's a bore. Blind needs won't set you free. Can't you see that time is slipping away? But I got to say, how much is enough? When your soul is empty, how much is enough? In the land of plenty, when you have all you want and you still feel nothing at all, how much is enough is enough? When we were dreaming, something slipped away. We're drowning in possessions, playing tricks with our mind. When your soul is empty, how much is enough in the land of plenty? When you have all you want and you still feel nothing at all, how much is enough?"
So much joy can be achieved free or at little or no cost. How much do we need to watch the sunrise over our beautiful ocean? What joy we can get from walking the Mokotohatchee Boardwalk, seeing mommy great blue heron coming back to the nest, reaching her bill down with food for her baby who is awaiting her return. We don't need a McMansion to enjoy a chocolate peanut butter ice cream cone on a hot day, or to sit here among friends looking out at the beautiful sanctuary garden. You may have heard that a gratitude journal can powerfully improve your mood. Keeping tabs on your daily appreciations can help you focus on just how many little things there are to celebrate in life. Mind-body coach and behavioral health specialist Jane Pernato Ehrman of the Cleveland Clinic Wellness Institute wrote that, quote, having a consistent positive focus helps to rewire the brain for greater responsiveness and positivity, while a negative focus wires the brain for greater reactivity and negative anticipation. There are the obvious things for which to be grateful, like family and friends and UUFBR and lovely soft mornings at the beach, maybe sitting on Norma Goodall's bench. I'm grateful for Mike Bullard and Jim Giovinazzo for contributing to this morning's service, and to Aaron and Erica Venable and their family for the stunning music, and for Bill Bodie, because without him, well, you wouldn't hear a word that we're saying, which maybe... To the ushers, thank you, ladies, for passing out the programs and your little pouches that we'll get to. And to the coffee angels, who never fail to have our goodies ready after service. But think about what you might be grateful for even beyond our daily living, such as being grateful that while we have so much further to go, that recently 53% of those polled supported same-sex marriage, as I'm compared with only 27% in 1996. I'm grateful for Michael Moore, for Bill Maher, and for Jane Goodall. I'm grateful for Meow Meow, Speckles, Jindy, Cookie, and Mishu, who have saved me from a life of boredom. I'm grateful for my friend and family. I'm grateful for those who toil in the fields in rain and hot sun, and the animals whose lives have been sacrificed so that I can put food on my table. I have so much for which to be grateful.
I was born in a quiet little town of Elyria, Ohio, just west of Cleveland. My parents were both Italian immigrants. The neighborhood was Italian, Polish, blacks, and Jews. People tended to socialize among their own ethnic groups. But we children all played together out on the streets, and often going to everyone's yards at night and eating fruit out of their trees while they didn't know about it. I was not aware of any serious discrimination until I attended college at the University of Dayton in Dayton, Ohio in the late 50s. And the discrimination was very surprising to me and very, very evident. I graduated from the University of Dayton with a degree in education, and I taught school for 30 years in the inner city of Dayton, Ohio. While teaching social studies in high school, I believed that education had to go beyond the classroom walls. So I volunteered to be an advisor for an after-school club called JCAWA, Junior Council on World Affairs. The national organization always sponsored a trip at spring break to Washington, D.C. and New York City, and students visited the monuments in Washington, had pictures taken with their representatives, and then on to New York City and to the United Nations facilities. The national organization, most of the students were of low-income families, so I would raise the money to enable the students to be able to attend each year. During the Nixon administration, local governments and communities could receive money to improve social conditions in the inner city. With the permission of the Board of Education, I was able to raise $1,500 to have after-school activities for students of low-income single-parent families. All of the students were volunteers, and all of the adults were volunteers, and we managed to keep the kids off the streets until their parents could pick them up. And this did have an impact on teenage gangs in the neighborhood. Since I have been in South Florida, I have also volunteered at the Florence Fuller Child Development Center. And as a member of the League of Women Voters, and I have a badge that says not for women only, and have participated on committee activities dealing with child education and election reforms. And I'm sure you're aware of much of this discussion lately on reforms. The Peace Organization now has given me an opportunity to work with interdenominational groups. There is power in interdenominational church members to solve social problems, and with this power that we have worked very well together to make changes in our neighborhoods. I have found gratitude and pleasure for myself to think that I have changed my little piece of the world.
I have much to be grateful for, but I want to talk about a specific area that I'm grateful for. It's very practical in a way, but very complicated also. And it is that I'm grateful for health insurance. Now, for those of you who know me, that makes a lot of sense because I've been in benefits for years, and I know a fair amount about health insurance, and I sell it. So, of course, it's partly of my income. But I also know, especially in the last 4 or 5 years with the state of the economy, that many people have found out they can't get health insurance. Our employment-based health insurance system means that if you lose your job and you have any kind of medical conditions, you can't get health insurance. It doesn't matter how much you want it. So I'm grateful for Obamacare. I'm grateful that it's coming in January for all the people who won't have it. And on a personal level, I'm intensely grateful because in January, my own health insurance went up to $1,800 a month and I had to drop it. So I've gone without health insurance, which is an embarrassing thing for an insurance agent to say. But I do have something more to be grateful for, and I would like to share that with you, if I may. All right? God on high heard my prayer. In my need, he sent Medicare. Almost 65, but still alive, and I'll thrive now that I've got Medicare. June 1st, I got Medicare. I am so grateful.
We follow that. Well, we're going to follow that by asking all of you to think about what you're grateful for. Pick up the gratitude bag you received when you arrived. This is a way to carry life's gifts with you. Give some thought to some of the things for which you are most grateful. And we're going to take time to jot down a few words that represent each thought on your gratitude cards. We're going to take some time to give you a few minutes to think about your blessings. So take your gratitude bag with you, and from time to time, take it out and add something that brings you joy or for which you have found gratitude. Keep adding to your cards and be grateful. When you have a bad day, take it out and look at your grateful list. When you find yourself thinking negative thoughts about your life or who you are, stop and find three things about yourself for which you are grateful. Interrupting destructive self-talk with gratitude helps to build your confidence instead of tearing it down. When we're facing the everyday problems and challenges of life, we can get very focused on what's going wrong. One of the fastest ways to feel happier is to express gratitude for what you already have and for what's going right for you. The effect of gratitude is immediate. The happiest people have an attitude of gratitude. Let's all vow to practice it daily, starting today.